Good day. Today's Wednesday, 5th November 2025, and let me first take this opportunity before I start with this video to remind you to tick the like button. If once you have watched and listened to the video, or whichever part of the video you want to watch and listen to, you decide that you've liked the video and want to indicate that fact. Now, let me proceed now with the rest of the video, and let me once again say that the greater part of this video is going to be devoted to the situation in Ukraine, where things, in my opinion, are starting to move ever faster. But before I discuss Ukraine, let me just say a few things about the situation in Venezuela. And let me also quickly touch upon certain elections that have just taken place in the United States. On Venezuela, we now have another article about the situation in Venezuela, or at least about US military moves with respect to Venezuela in the New York Times. And it has outlined a whole series of potential military steps that the United States may be about to take against Venezuela. And it spoke about three options, even though it also acknowledged that these three options are not really mutually exclusive and that all three of them could be put into action at one and the same time. One is for military strikes against Venezuelan military installations, and perhaps against the political and military leadership of Venezuela. The second is some kind of extraction operation in which US special forces attempt to capture President Maduro himself and some of his key leaders to bring them presumably to the United States. Something that is a little like what happened when the United States invaded Panama back in the 1988 and achieved the arrest and removal to the United States of the Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega, who I believe is still in prison in the United States, though I'm not sure about that. He might have departed the scene, for all I know. And the third is of the United States combining military strikes with the occupation and capture of certain key installations within Venezuela, including oil fields and such things. I am sure that if there is a military attack on Venezuela, all three of these things will happen at one and the same time, exactly as the New York Times is saying. The New York Times also, however, says that President Trump himself is unable to make his mind up between these three options, or whether to conduct an attack on Venezuela at all. Hamlet-like, he is trapped in indecision. To do or not to do. He apparently worries that the operation might be more complicated than he is being told, that it might go wrong, and he is very much afraid of being blamed if it does. Well, I don't know whether this picture is true. President Trump has in the past shown some wariness about getting involved in these very complicated military operations. But I'm going to say what I have said previously, that sooner or later, even if these doubts exist, these doubts will be quelled. He has already moved far too many forces to the immediate vicinity of Venezuela. He's made far too many comments about President Maduro to pull back now without this, at least in his own mind, resulting in a loss of face. And though losing face is never a good reason to go to war, in fact, it is a terrible reason to go to war, fear of losing face. Fear of losing face, unfortunately, is a major problem or characteristic of this particular president, and I can't help but think that ultimately it is going to drive him forward. Now, there's been a lot of rumours about military aid that Russia is supposedly providing to Venezuela, and there are reports that Russian transport aircraft are supplying Venezuela with all kinds of advanced weapons. About the Russians, for example, providing advanced book missile anti-air defense missile systems to Venezuela, and the Russians providing advanced cruise missiles to Venezuela, and that kind of thing. And of course, a Russian official, I believe he's actually a Russian MP, a lawmaker, has made some, I think, extremely reckless and unwise comments about there being no reason why Russia should not locate Oreshnik missile systems in Venezuela. I think that was a very unwise statement, by the way, and a very provocative one, and one which is more likely to tilt the discussions in Washington towards military intervention in Venezuela, always assuming, of course, that that decision has not already been made. The reason I have some doubts about the supply by Russia of these advanced systems to Venezuela are basically twofold. Firstly, there is the obvious logistical technical challenge. This has been discussed at great length by Brian Beletic, for example, in connection with Ukraine. And in fact, it has been consistently visible in the conflict in Ukraine from the moment it first started. This is that simply supplying advanced weapons to a particular country is not anywhere close to making those weapons an effective part of that country's military arsenal. So, to give an example, if we're talking about book air defense missile systems, the Venezuelan military need to be trained to operate these systems and to learn how to operate them. And that takes time. A few months ago, I was provided with information, which I believe to be true, about Russian supplies or future supplies of S-400 air defense missiles to Iran. And my informant told me that Iranian personnel are currently training on how to operate these S-400 systems in Russia, that the training program will last at least a year, and that the Russians believe that it takes 2 years of intense training before a group of operators can attain full proficiency in the use of these weapons. Now, the book system is a less sophisticated and less powerful system than the S-400, and it may be that the time needed to gain proficiency is going to be significantly less. But realistically, it cannot happen within a few days. And that must beg the question of why, in that case, would Russia supply the book system to Venezuela at all? It would only do so, and this would certainly be true if Russia were supplying Calibre missiles as well, for example, if Russian personnel were being sent to Venezuela as well in order to operate these systems. Now, that would be an enormous escalation. It would mean Russian operators shooting down or trying to shoot down American aircraft in Latin America and perhaps attacking American warships in the Caribbean. Well, it has happened before. During the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, there were Russian military personnel in Cuba. Some of them were air defense personnel, and they did shoot down an American spy aircraft, a U-2, I think it was, flying over Cuba, just to say. So this is not wholly without precedent, but is it realistically going to happen this time, given the enormous preponderance of forces that there are in the Caribbean and the real probability that deploying and using Russian troops in this kind of way would expose them to death or capture by the far more powerful military that the United States has in the region, without, so far as I can see, providing Russia with any political or geopolitical benefits whatsoever. On the contrary, it would be far more likely to enrage the Americans, and in particular Donald Trump, and might hasten the decision by President Trump to deploy Tomahawk missiles operated by American personnel in Ukraine, which the Russians have gone out of their way to warn against. So that is one reason why I am skeptical about these claims. The second reason is one that, in effect, one can find buried in the first reason, which is that by this time, deliveries of advanced weapons of that kind to Venezuela would be coming far too late to change in any significant way the military balance. In terms of technology and firepower, the United States has overwhelming superiority in the Caribbean and in Latin America over whatever forces Venezuela can deploy and whatever weapons Russia sends to Venezuela to resist the Americans. It seems to me very likely, a strong possibility, that at the very least, whatever happens to the long-term war in Venezuela, assuming, as I do, that the United States proposes to attack the country, it is very likely that weapon systems, advanced weapon systems supplied to Venezuela by Russia, Buk missiles, Calibre cruise missiles, those kind of things, would fall, perhaps even intact, into America's possession as a result of an attack on Venezuela. And that would compromise the systems. And I doubt very, very much that that is what the Russians would do. Now, I have not seen any reports that the Venezuelan government has asked Russia for help of this kind. I think it is more likely than not that the Russians are providing assistance to Venezuela to refit and refurbish the Sukhoi 30 fighter jets, of which Venezuela already has 20, and also to provide Venezuela with intelligence assistance, which can be provided from Russia, and that kind of thing. And I suspect that China is doing roughly the same. But people should not expect more than can realistically take place. In this part of the world, American power is heavily preponderant. The Russians know it, and it is inevitably going to affect what they do. Venezuela's best defense is not military supplies from Russia. It is the size of the country, the difficult geography with its mountains and its jungles, and the support, if it exists, of its people, who, according to some claims, strongly oppose this American intervention, and who are already heavily armed and who might decide to resist it. Those factors might be enough to deter the United States, and if they are not, but they still prove to be real, then they could in time create a debacle in Latin America for the United States. Anyway, that is what I want to say about the Venezuela situation. Now, there's been these elections in the United States, and I'm not going to spend any time discussing them. Mostly, the media has focused on the fact that Democrats have won in a few places. It seems to me this is the usual thing that one expects to see after a president has been elected. There's usually a pendulum swing back to the opposition, and that is completely unsurprising, given that the president in question is this deeply polarizing figure, who is, of course, Donald Trump. But there's been particular angst, or euphoria, if you prefer, about the victory of Mamdani, the self-described socialist candidate in New York, who is proposing various ideas for rent controls, free transport and government-subsidized groceries, which many Americans in New York seem attracted to, given the cost of living crisis that most people acknowledge is taking place in that city. Now, I'm going to say straightforwardly this. I think that this is an interesting election, and Mr. Mamdani, no doubt, is an interesting man. But I think that its importance should not be overstressed by the standards of the rest of America. New York has generally been a fairly left-wing place. It has elected Republicans from time to time, but mostly throughout my lifetime anyway, it has tended to veer somewhat to the left. And of course, there is a cost of living crisis in America, and we do have the polarizing personality of Donald Trump, which might have radicalized some New York voters, at least to some degree. I say this because I can remember something very similar happening in Britain, in London to be precise, in the 1980s, when a similar radical socialist politician with many similar ideas, including a reorganization of the transport system in London, was elected mayor of London, and that, of course, was Ken Livingstone. And there was a lot of the same reaction in Britain to Ken Livingstone's election as there appears to be to Mamdani's election in New York. And, well, Livingstone actually was a by no means ineffective and by no means unsuccessful mayor. He did carry out changes to the transport system, and though these remain unpopular with some people, at the time, Londoners in general thought that they were beneficial and effective. What transformed Livingstone from a purely London phenomenon into a national one was that the then Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, responded to his election in a not dissimilar way to the way that Donald Trump looks likely to respond to Mamdani's election. And I think that would be unwise, because what happened in the 1980s in Britain was that Livingstone was able to ride the sympathy came to him as a result of the various acts of harassment that Margaret Thatcher and her government undertook against him, which made it possible for him to blame his failures on and problems on her rather than on anything that he himself had done. And of course his popularity rose, and for a certain period in British political history he became an actually quite important national figure. So I would say that a certain measure of calm and proportion is needed in the United States, in New York. Let's see what Mr. Mamdani actually does before jumping to any conclusions, and let's not be too fast about the labels that he has appropriated or which have been foisted upon him. Let's not worry too much about those. Let's see what actually he delivers or fails to deliver before making or rushing to any particular conclusions. Now, just to finish on this, let me also say something else. I am not personally in the United States as I make this program. I was there just a few weeks ago, but only for a short time. But I'm getting more and more of a sense that the economic situation in the United States is souring fast. There seems to be significantly less spending going on inside the economy. There are reports that money supply is starting to contract. There are various indicators which may suggest that beneath the macro, the economic numbers and the speculative boom, AI-connected boom, that is taking place in the American stock markets, the real economy, as it is sometimes called, might already be in recession. If this is true, then this presumably explains, or at least goes some way to explaining Mamdani's election. In which case, the best way to respond to that is to address the problems thrown up by the recession. And that might require a rethink of some of the economic policies, and other policies too, by the way, which have led to that recession. That, of course, on the assumption that you believe that Mamdani's election is the very, very bad thing that some people say, about which, as I indicated a moment ago, I prefer to hold back and wait and see. Anyway, with all of that, let me now turn to the situation in Ukraine, and let me begin where I basically left off in my program yesterday, because yesterday I discussed at very considerable length the truly astonishing, bizarre comments made yesterday by President Zelensky of Ukraine, that the situation in Pokrovsk was swinging in Ukraine's favour, that Ukraine had won the Battle of Kupiansk, that there were only around 250 to 300 Russian troops in Pokrovsk, that in Kupiansk there were only 60 Russian troops left there, that the Ukrainians were busy mopping them up or rounding them up, and that the Battle of Kupiansk had been a great victory for Ukraine. And I said in my program yesterday that this all looked to me, based on every other piece of information I have seen, not just wrong, but frankly completely delusional. So completely disconnected from reality that it did leave one gasping and wondering what exactly it is that Zelensky himself is thinking, and what he either knows or doesn't know. Anyway, the Russian Defense Ministry has now responded to these truly astonishing claims. They've published this statement. Vladimir Zelensky's statement to journalists that in Kupiansk, the Ukrainian military is allegedly mopping up the remaining 60 Russians can testify to two things. One, the head of the Kiev regime has completely lost connection with reality, and whilst listening to the false reports of Sirsky, has absolutely no control over the operational situation on the ground. Or two, on the contrary, he understands the desperate situation and the real situation of the Ukrainian military in Kupiansk. Therefore, at the cost of the shameless death of thousands of Ukrainian servicemen in the pockets, he tries to hide all the truth from the population of Ukraine and his Western sponsors in order to continue to profit from the funds allocated to the war against Russia by European taxpayers. Otherwise, it is impossible to consider his words, "We will mop up everything." Today, the situation of the Ukrainian military groups trapped in the encirclements of Kupiansk and Pokrovsk, which continue to suffer significant losses from strikes and advances of the Russian troops, is rapidly deteriorating, leaving no chance for Ukrainian servicemen to save themselves except through voluntary surrender. Well, that is what the Russian Defense Ministry has said. And if you think about it, it's essentially the same as what I was saying yesterday. Either Zelensky believes this nonsense that he's saying, in which case he has lost all touch with reality, in which case he is no longer competent to lead Ukraine in the middle of a war, or he is deliberately lying to the Ukrainian people, and in the most grotesque way to the Ukrainian people and to the West, in which case this is an exercise in cynicism that leaves even a hardened person like me absolutely gasping for breath. So it has to be either one of those two. The Russian Defense Ministry, though they don't say that, clearly believes that it is two, that Zelensky is indeed lying, and that he's making up these fairy tales in order basically to mislead the Ukrainian public, perhaps parts of the Ukrainian army, those that are, of course, not trapped in these cauldrons, and, of course, the media and the politicians and the publics in the West. We'll come to that in a moment. Anyway, Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has also spoken up about this. He says that, you know that the media cannot currently make a trip to Pokrovsk because the Kiev regime has actually rejected such an opportunity and President Putin's proposal to allow this. So what is Kiev trying to conceal? It has been struggling to hide the truth about the deplorable situation of its troops in these areas. So that was Peskov's rather more moderately worded, perhaps rather less direct statement about Zelensky's words. But ultimately, makes a point which are no difference in substance from those made by the Russian Ministry of Defense. I get to say what I think here. I think more likely than not, there is the more cynical explanation that Zelensky's lying about the situation because he doesn't want the West and the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian army to know the truth. More likely than not, that is the true explanation for his comments. But I will say this, these assertions, these claims he made yesterday are so extremely, entirely, delusionally wrong that they're not even ultimately very good lies? What is going to happen when it is clear at some point over the next couple of days that Pokrovsk is indeed gone and Kupiansk is about to be gone also? Surely, assuming that Zelensky is lying, he knows that that moment is going to come. And what is his explanation for the things that he said yesterday? What is his explanation going to be when he is confronted by that situation then? I mean, it's a fair question if he really knows that what he's just saying now is untrue. Also, if he was just lying, would he be lying in quite this way? Wouldn't he be saying something a little bit more plausible? That yes, the situation in Pokrovsk is indeed very difficult, and the situation in Kupiansk is indeed very difficult, but the claims that the Russians are making that they've actually surrounded the troops there overstate the reality. There is a complex encounter battle underway. We are doing all that we need to do in order to keep the situation under control, and that if things do change, we will let everybody know and we will update them. Now, isn't that a more plausible approach to take if Zelensky really were trying to deceive people? I mean, this what he actually said is so completely at variance with the facts that far from persuading people, I can't help but think that it's more likely to provoke incredulity. I say this because I've been following the media in London very closely, and there is no media in the world that is more fervidly supportive of Ukraine than the media in London, and more fervidly supportive of Vladimir Zelensky himself than the media in London. And I notice that they are clearly so taken aback and embarrassed by these claims that he has just made that they are barely reporting them. If they really believe them to be true, they would be repeating them. There would be articles about them. There would be commentaries about how it was Putin who was living on a different planet and had lost touch with reality, something of that kind. The fact that they've downplayed them to the extent that they have shows that they have their doubts about them and that they are, frankly, well, not willing to believe them. By the way, this is starting to become true increasingly about British coverage, media coverage of the state of the war. There is a long article today in the Financial Times about the fact that the Russians have now developed jet-powered fab bombs, that they've added jet engines to some of their bombs, which means that Sukhoi 34 aircraft are able to launch their bombs from much longer distances, staying well outside the coverage of the Ukrainian air defense system and enabling them to hit targets in Ukraine well behind the front lines. I read the article through. I was waiting to find the catch, the part of the article which would say, well, you know, this is what the Russians have achieved, but this isn't going to change anything. There are all kinds of problems that this is a badly thought out technology that isn't going to be effective, and the place where the Ukrainian countermeasures would be discussed. And the catch never came. It just blandly reported the whole recent introduction of jet-powered, precision-guided bombs by the Russians on the battlefield. And it was just plain factual reporting. Very unusual at this point in the war, and perhaps another sign that some people in London are now starting to have their doubts. So anyway, what, regardless, given how wild and exaggerated Zelensky's words were, I have to say that I do think that at some level he lives in a different reality from most people and isn't able any longer to absorb the realities of the battlefields. And no doubt he is getting a lot of false reports from Sirski and from others. And I think that, yes, probably at some level there is a degree of cynicism about this. But I continue to think that at some level also Zelensky does believe, or has, or is pretending to himself to believe, that some of what he is being told is true. Anyway, speaking of Zelensky, he did actually go to the front lines yesterday, or close to the front lines. He visited the town of Dobropilia, which is located to the north of Pokrovsk. This is in the general area of the Russian breakthrough of August, and it is in the area where there has been this constant encounter battle. Sirski has deployed large numbers of reinforcements, or began to deploy large numbers of reinforcements to precisely this area in the summer, in August. And the Ukrainians have tried to conduct various counterattacks in this area to try to roll back the Russian breakthrough, with very mixed results altogether, and some would say without much success. Anyway, Zelensky did come to Dobropilia, where he did meet some of the commanders, and presumably did hear some reports. He wasn't there for very long, because shortly after he was back in Kiev, and bear in mind, in order for him to travel to the front, he must travel by train or car. So the distance from Kiev to Dobropilia is actually quite lengthy. And that means that since he was back in Kiev later, he can't have been in Dobropilia for very long. Anyway, he then returned to Kiev, where he subsequently had a meeting with the US ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker. Now, Matthew Whitaker is someone who regularly appears on US television and who regularly makes comments about the war and the diplomacy, or lack of it. And the overwhelming impression I have got listening to Mr. Whitaker is that with respect to Russia, he's very, very much of a hardliner. He's clearly outwardly loyal to the president, to Donald Trump. But my sense is that he doesn't like the Russians and is very pro-Ukrainian and wants the war to end very much on Ukraine's and America's terms. And he has been loudly supportive, for example, of the recent American sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. And he has also spoken up, or talked up, American arms deliveries to Ukraine as well. As you would, of course, expect from an official who is currently America's ambassador to NATO. Anyway, he came to Kiev. And again, bear in mind that for any official from Europe to travel to Ukraine and to Kiev itself, that official must go to Kiev by train. Anyway, he arrived in Kiev and he met Zelensky in his office. And the reports say that Whitaker impressed upon Zelensky that a diplomatic resolution to the war is needed. Now, I wonder why Whitaker went to Kiev at precisely this time. And I wonder whether perhaps he might have been sent by someone in the administration, maybe Donald Trump himself, because the Americans are starting to get nervous about the reports on the battlefields, about the crisis in Pokrovsk and the crisis in Kupiansk. And I also wonder whether perhaps one of the explanations for Zelensky's truly extraordinary statements is that the people he's really addressing are the Americans. After all, he apparently told Trump just 2 weeks ago when they met in the White House in Washington that Ukraine is winning the war, that it is holding the Russians back. He apparently showed to Trump various maps that he brought with him, which supposedly showed how the Ukrainians were holding their own and were even pushing the Russians back in places. Trump apparently was scornful and eventually became angry and threw the maps aside and apparently told Zelensky that unless he did agree to withdraw from Donbass, then the Russians would eventually roll right over him and Ukraine might cease to exist. Anyway, that was the account that we received of this very tough, difficult meeting between Zelensky and Trump, which took place the day after Trump spoke to Putin. And Putin told him that under no circumstances must Trump even think about sending Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. Anyway, Zelensky managed, despite the fact that this meeting was difficult, to keep Trump on side. Obviously, he wasn't the only one. The Europeans no doubt played their part, as did the hardliners within the administration itself, Rubio and Kellogg and Waltz and people like that. And it seems that Trump went away from the meeting accepting Zelensky's assurances that the war was indeed bogged down and in stalemate, that the Russians weren't breaking through, that there was still time, and that Trump should therefore revert to the position he had before his meeting with Putin in Alaska, which was that Ukraine and Russia should freeze the conflict by agreeing to a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines. So, despite the fact that the meeting was tough and difficult for Zelensky, he probably came away feeling overall that he got what he wanted from the meeting. He didn't get the Tomahawks, but he got Trump to come back to the position of supporting a freeze of the conflict and a ceasefire, to which Zelensky himself had agreed in March, and which has been Zelensky's preferred policy ever since. So Zelensky probably came away on balance feeling that he'd come out ahead of that meeting, at least on points. But all of this, of course, was predicated on the lie that Ukraine is holding its ground in Donbass, so that it doesn't need to surrender Donbass in its entirety to the Russians, because the Russians, absent that surrender, would never capture it. In fact, that, as we see, is untrue. The Russians probably now hold at least 90% of Pokrovsk. It may be that as of now, when I am making this program, they hold all of Pokrovsk. And as I've discussed in many programs, the fall of Pokrovsk will mean the end of Ukrainian control of Donbass. The fall of Pokrovsk, in other words, and the fall of Kupiansk, would expose what Zelensky said to Trump just 2 weeks ago as a brazen lie. So one can understand the worries now in Washington and why they might have sent Whitaker to talk to Zelensky. Whitaker, the implication would be, look, you told us that you were holding the line in Donbass, but obviously that isn't true. You're about to lose Pokrovsk and probably Kupiansk too. So why don't you agree to what Putin is demanding and the president himself, Donald Trump, floated, which is the surrender of Donbass to the Russians in return for a ceasefire in other places and a process leading eventually to Istanbul Plus. Because if you continue to dig in, you will lose Donbass at some point over the next couple of months, at which point our leverage over the Russians, and by extension, your leverage too, will have gone, and we will, all of us, be looking at a debacle. So it seems to me that though Whitaker would not have spelled it out in that way, that must have been the subtext of much of the discussion that took place, and it probably explains the words that we see about this meeting, that Whitaker told Zelensky that the time had come to find a way to end the war. Well, Zelensky was completely unreceptive. He seems to have made no step towards seeking a diplomatic compromise. He showed no willingness to retreat a millimetre from Donbass. He demanded more air defence missiles, and he demanded more sanctions against Russia. He seems to have gone to Dobropilia, not in order to find out what the real situation there actually was, what the true situation on the battlefield was, but in order to marshal, to assemble discussion points that he could make to Whitaker in order to push back against American, possible American demands that he give ground, perhaps surrendering Donbass. If by now people in Washington have not understood that Zelensky is a major roadblock towards a negotiated solution of the war, then I wonder, frankly, when they will. I regard the information about this latest exchange between Zelensky and Whitaker as a further example of the point I'm making. However bad the situation on the front lines becomes, however catastrophic the overall situation in the Ukrainian economy is, and I've discussed that extensively in my last two programs, however fractured the political system remains in Ukraine, so long as Zelensky continues to be Zelensky's president, Ukraine's president, there will be no move towards peace, because he will always act to block that peace by rejecting any realistic compromise with the Russians. Bear in mind that in September, October 2022, he issued a decree prohibiting any Ukrainian official from conducting negotiations with the Russians, despite the fact that under overwhelming pressure from Donald Trump and the United States, he has permitted two negotiating sessions between Ukrainian and Russian negotiating teams to take place in Istanbul. Zelensky has never revoked that decree. The decree remains in place, and as the Russians never cease to point out, so long as that decree remains in place, Ukraine can always walk away from whatever agreement it says it has made with the Russians by claiming that that agreement is null and void because it was agreed via negotiations, which by operation of this decree under Ukrainian law cannot happen and are therefore null and void in themselves. Now, anyway, that's, it seems to me, the diplomatic situation. It continues to be in deadlock. There's been a long analysis of the diplomacy in the Russian media. I don't intend to discuss it in any detail. But what I would say is that the Russians themselves have mentioned, have discussed things very much in the way that I've said, and basically their point is that there is no conceivable way of moving forward with the negotiations with the Americans because they are stuck, because Ukraine, and backed by the Europeans, continues to be completely intransigent. The article, if anybody wants to look it up, is it Nezavisimaya Gazeta? Washington lacks leverage over allies, Kiev, as it seeks to manage Russia tensions. And it says this, that Donald Trump, since his inauguration, has periodically signaled a willingness to take into account the considerations of Russian negotiators regarding the outlines of a peace deal. Russia's position is, and always has been, that an immediate ceasefire would merely allow the Ukrainian armed forces to regroup and maneuver, creating the risk of renewed hostilities. However, the US president has subsequently once again declared an immediate ceasefire to be a necessary move, and he has now moved forward to impose the sanctions. And then, according to Nezavisimaya Gazeta, Yevgeny Semibratov, deputy director of the Institute for Strategic Studies and Forecasts of the People's Friendship University in Moscow, explained these divergent statements by suggesting that the recent missile tests in Russia might have had an impact on Washington's thinking, and but also that the administration lacks sufficient leverage to influence either Western globalist circles, the words globalist circles appear in the article, including the United Kingdom or Zelensky himself. The United Kingdom, aware that Washington is weak on the details of the settlement, are deliberately seeking to complicate the negotiation process in order to push the United States to align with its position. And any step towards Moscow would be depicted in the Western media as a concession and a sign of personal weakness on Trump's part, an outcome which doesn't mesh with his political agenda. So basically what this is saying is that the Russians have concluded that Trump is negotiation incapable, even if he does sometimes have glimmers of understanding of what needs to be done to end the war, even if sometimes some of the realities, the missile developments, the deployments, the Russian breakthroughs on the battlefronts, cut through with him. At the end of the day, he will never take the necessary steps to rein Zelensky in because he's afraid of being called weak towards Putin, and that will always bring him back into line in the end. Anyway, there we go. I've spent enough time, I think, discussing the diplomacy such as it is, which is very little at the moment, if any at all. And, of course, Zelensky and his potential motives. To repeat again, though, Zelensky will never agree to a peace, even as he is about to lose Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. He continues to insist that all is well and won't compromise. And this will continue right up to the moment when the Russians reach Kiev itself and perhaps beyond. And Trump will never find the will or the strength to put Zelensky, to bring Zelensky into line and to break with the Europeans and the neocons who surround him, assuming, of course, that he even has the inclination to do so. Anyway, let's now turn to the situation on the battlefronts. And actually, there's been a cascade of further news here. And where better to start than the Russian Defense Ministry, who have provided us with more information about the situation in Kupiansk and Pokrovsk. And this is what they say about Kupiansk. They say that units of the 6th Army continue to destroy the encircled enemy group close to Kupiansk. Over the past 24 hours, four counterattacks launched by units of the 92nd Assault Brigade and 151st Mechanized Brigade of the Ukrainian Army and the 1st National Guard Brigade have been thwarted near Monachinovka, Blagodatovka and Petrovka. Over the past 24 hours, 50 troops, 26 pieces of weapons, including one M113 armoured personnel carrier and one US-made 155mm Paladin self-propelled artillery system, seven armoured vehicles, two mortars, one lorry and eight pickup trucks were neutralised close to Pokrovsk. In total, more than 230 troops, 11 armoured fighting vehicles, 22 motor vehicles and two field artillery guns of the Ukrainian military have been subdued in the area of the Zapad West Group of Forces. Six electronic warfare stations, one counter-fire radar and six ammunition depots were destroyed as well. So that is according to the Russian Defense Ministry. The situation for the Ukrainians in the Kupiansk pocket continues to deteriorate, and all attempts to break through the encirclement have been unsuccessful. As is always the way, the Russian Defense Ministry provides more information about the situation in Pokrovsk. Assault groups of the 2nd and 51st Armies continue to destroy the Ukrainian troops encircled in a residential area of the Prigorodny district, in the eastern part of the central district, and in the private sector of Pokrovsk. The offensive continues in the northern direction. In addition, the planned destruction of Ukrainian troops is underway. 24 buildings have been liberated in Gnatovka and Rog. That must be, by the way, a significant part of these two villages, which are quite small. Russian troops thwarted the enemy's attempts to break through the encirclement ring. During the day, 12 counterattacks of the enemy were repelled in the northern and northwestern directions of Pokrovsk. Now, these look to be attacks that the Ukrainians have been carrying out to break into Pokrovsk from the north, and there's been quite a lot of information about this, but it does seem overall as if the Ukrainian attacks in places like Rodinska and elsewhere have been unsuccessful. And as we will see in a moment, there has been video footage which suggests that the Russians are indeed expanding the territory under their control north of Pokrovsk itself. But notice again that they're saying the 24 buildings were liberated in Gnatovka and Rog, and that they're mopping up operations in the Prigorodny district, in the eastern part of the central district, and in the private sector. The speed in which buildings are being captured by the Russians and the absence of information of actual fighting going on inside the Pokrovsk pocket further confirms, at least to me, that the resistance from the Ukrainian troops inside Pokrovsk is collapsing. Some brave souls continue to put up a resistance where they can, but mostly resistance where it exists is weak and disorganized and without much in the way of effectiveness. And we are then told that units of the 51st Army of the 5th Motorized Rifle Brigade liberated 19 buildings in northern, eastern and southern eastern parts of Mirnograd, another, as I said, rapid collapse, and moved towards Zapatny neighbourhood. The expansion of the control zone and tightening of the enemy's encirclement continues. And according to the Russians, within the Pokrovsk pocket, the Ukrainians lost up to 470 troops, 6 armoured fighting vehicles, 9 motor vehicles, 1 artillery gun, and, well, other equipment as well. So the Russians continue to insist that the battles of Pokrovsk and Kupiansk are going their way. And we have some video footage from the Pokrovsk area, and that does indeed suggest that the Russians continue to enlarge the territory that they control north of Pokrovsk, and that they have now tightened the siege of Pokrovsk significantly. In fact, there's been a claim that the distance between Russian troops who have been taking positions north of Pokrovsk along the roads leading south from Rodinska and the Russian troops in who are advancing northeast of Pokrovsk, that the distance between these Russian troops has now shrunk to just 100 meters, which of course is it's unreal if the Russian units are just 100 meters apart from each other on a map. That means that they have effectively joined, in which case Pokrovsk is indeed fully surrounded by the Russians, by the Russian army on all sides. The siege has tightened in exactly the way that the Russian Defense Ministry is saying. Now, my own view, as I said, is that there is little in the way of actual resistance taking place in the pocket, in the cauldron. I think that the major Russian objective at the moment is to get Ukrainian troops inside the cauldron to surrender rather than to engage them in battle. After all, what realistic choice do the Ukrainians have? Some of them might be willing to fight and die, but many others, probably, when they review the hopelessness of the situation, and especially if they have some awareness of the nonsense Zelensky is saying about them, will presumably make the decision, the logical decision, which is that the time has come for them to surrender. Putin has been going out of his way to say that the Russians will treat the Ukrainian prisoners in a humane way, and, well, obviously that is in part being said in order to make the option of surrender an even more attractive one. Now, there have been reports and even some video footage showing Ukrainian troops surrendering. At the moment, it appears to be isolated cases of surrender. But when this starts to happen, especially in these sort of conditions, eventually there's going to be a breaking point, and we're going to probably start to see mass surrenders begin very quickly. For the record, I don't think that any of the maps of the cauldron, of the Pokrovsk cauldron, are accurate any longer. I think that the area of the cauldron has now shrunk to just a few square kilometres. I believe most of the cauldron, most of the areas of the cauldron, which are shown as being still under Ukrainian control, are actually under Russian control, or at least in the grey zone. And I think that the conditions in the cauldron are now becoming so bad that I wonder whether resistance can continue for much longer. Anyway, that is the situation, as far as I can see, on the battlefronts. Everywhere else, for the Ukrainians, it gets worse and worse. In Zaporozhye region, from what I've been able to understand, the consensus amongst the mapping and reporting projects is that the Russians now control most of Uspenivka. They still have positions, Ukrainian positions, to capture at the northern and southern ends of this large village. The Russians have expanded significantly the territory they control in Primorska, a village to the south of the great city of Zaporozhye. It's been pointed out that if they capture this village, they're in a position to cut communications to Ukrainian forces that are located to the east, because Russian drone operators can work and can inhibit movement along the roads, the supply roads, that the Ukrainians use to send supplies to the troops, the Ukrainian troops that are defending themselves in these various places. There's less information about what is happening in Liman and Siversk over the last 24 hours, which I would take, by the way, as a sign that an intense battle in both of these places is underway and that the Russians are making progress, just as they probably are in Konstantinovka too. And there are some reasons to think, from claims that the Russian Defense Ministry is now making, that the Russians are reactivating their offensive in Sumy region and also in Kharkiv region, where there are only a few locations at the eastern end of Volchansk that need to be captured before all of Volchansk falls. In a program that we did with him, with Stanislav Krapivnik, a few days ago on the Duran, he pointed out that the major Russian objective in Kharkiv region has been to take control of the high ground, including around the city of Kharkiv itself, and that the Russians are now close to achieving that objective, in which case, of course, any future offensive to capture the city of Kharkiv itself will become much simpler. Anyway, that's the news on the war. There's been quite a lot of comments about the state of the war on the Ukrainian side too. I read a commentary by a Ukrainian soldier talking about basically the crisis on the front lines. It's not just that there is a massive shortage of infantry, so that there is in many places no longer a proper stable front line. It is that the presence of the Russian drones behind the front line, disrupting logistics, and the Russian bombing with the increasingly long-range FAB bombs is choking the front of supplies. And I think it was this same Ukrainian soldier who said that, for example, the main supply road from Izium in Kharkiv region to Slavyansk — Izium is one of these key urban centres that the Russians need to capture, or presumably would want to capture, in order to advance on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the north. Izium has been referred to in the past as the gateway to Donbass. The Russians controlled it for a time in 2022, but the Ukrainians recaptured it. Perhaps the most important achievement of the Ukrainians in their offensives of the autumn of 2022 was the recapture of Izium. Anyway, the key road between Izium and Slavyansk, one of the major supply roads in the war, according to this Ukrainian, has become a road of death. Any vehicles, any traffic between Izium and Slavyansk is intensely vulnerable to attack by Russian drones. The Russian drones are already patrolling this key highway and are wreaking massive damage. I remember back in 2024, I said that there was, the summer of 2024, I said that there was a marked contrast between the way in which the Russians and the Ukrainians use their drones on the battlefronts. The Ukrainians use their drones as a kind of artillery against the Russians when the Russians conduct attacks against Ukrainian lines. In other words, the Ukrainians use their drones on the actual battlefield. The Russians use their drones quite differently, to attack the supply routes sending supplies to the front lines. Mostly the Russian drones don't operate on the front lines as such, but immediately to the Ukrainian rear. And that rear is expanding, and apparently it has now reached a depth of 35 kilometers behind the front lines, 35 kilometers in some places behind the front lines, where the Russian drones operate, aggravating the crisis the Ukrainians feel. Now, let me now move to the last part of this program, which is to a speech that Putin made in the Kremlin, in the Catherine Hall of the Senate Palace of the Kremlin, the hall where, in Stalin's time, the Soviet Central Committee used to meet, just to say. Anyway, Putin gave a speech there, and this speech was connected to awards that he was providing to the designers of the Burevestnik nuclear-powered cruise missile and the Poseidon nuclear-powered submarine drone. Now, I've been provided with an analysis about these two weapon systems. In the case of the Burevestnik cruise missile, it's been suggested that certain aspects of its nuclear reactor and the fact that this is not actually an especially stealthy cruise missile would, in theory, make it relatively easy to detect. The problem is, because this cruise missile has an almost unlimited range, well, has in effect an unlimited range, in order to counter attacks with these cruise missiles from all kinds of different directions, the United States would have to massively upgrade both its air defenses and its satellite arrays. And I was given a figure of the amount of additional satellite coverage the United States would need to develop in order to counter the Burevestnik. And all I will say is that it would be multiples of what exists today. In relation to the Poseidon nuclear-powered drone, at the present time, there is no effective counter against it at all, because it operates deep beneath the oceans. It is basically untraceable, and there is no simple way to counter it, given that it also possesses unlimited range. Anyway, these are some of the things that Putin had to say about these weapons, and they were very, very interesting. He said that, "I believe foreign specialists were able to learn about these characteristics firsthand, since during the testing of the Burevestnik on October 21st, a NATO reconnaissance vessel was continuously present in the trial zone. We did not interfere with its operation. They were allowed to watch." And we know that this is true because the Norwegians have provided us some information, including the fact that there was no radioactive leakage over the course of this test. And Putin went on to say, "I want to highlight the unique mode of powerful, ultra-small nuclear reactors in this missile. Their launch takes seconds, whereas regular reactors take hours or even a whole day. On the basis of such power systems, we are already developing a new generation of weapons. We have launched the development of next generation nuclear-powered cruise missiles. Their speed will be more than three times the speed of sound. Subsequently, they will become hypersonic. We have recently discussed this project and with some of our colleagues present here in this hall. Now just think of that. Hypersonic cruise missiles capable of striking anywhere in the United States because they have infinite range. The Russians have a hypersonic cruise missile, which is of course the Tsarkon, which is a ship launched system. What Putin seems to be discussing here is something like the Tsarkon. The Tsarkon uses some kind of air-breathing engine, which of course is what the Burevestnik also does. But obviously it would have to have different properties, a scramjet or a ramjet. I'm not going to discuss that because, well, to say it straightforwardly, I get lost in all discussions of these sort of things. And then he says that Poseidon's developers had their own specific tasks for operating a submarine system. I'm referring to using cutting-edge materials, nodes, and components that a device of this kind needs to enable it to be faster and go deeper up to 1,000 meters. In other words, 1 kilometer below the surface of the ocean. As for speed, it is several times faster compared to all the latest above water vessels. So I believe I'm right in saying that the average speed, top speed of say a US Navy carrier would be 30 kilometers, is 30 knots an hour. In which case, if we follow what Putin is saying, the Poseidon must be able to operate at around 100 knots an hour. Now, that is, again, an extraordinary thought. And maybe people in Washington should be taking heed of this. Now, to make it very clear, I am not happy at all about the development of these weapons, which I consider dangerous and destabilizing. But one has to respect the very significant technological breakthroughs that have taken place. And Putin had something to say about this. These technological breakthroughs do not come out of nowhere. It goes without saying that they represent the work and talent of many generations of our compatriots who started this research in the second half of the 20th century and persisted in their dedicated efforts. And what I have heard, and I can't vouch for the truth of this, is that the origins of these systems, the Poseidon and the Burevestnik, is from around 1980, that the Soviet Union became concerned about American plans to deploy cruise and Pershing missiles in Europe at that time, intermediate nuclear weapons in Europe at that time. And the Soviet leadership at that time took a decision that they would look for ways to develop weapon systems that would provide the Soviets with a counter, a balance to these American systems. In fact, I can remember Leonid Brezhnev making a speech in 1982 in which he said that the Soviets would look for ways to put the United States in an analogous geographical position to the one the Soviet Union was in if intermediate nuclear weapons like the Pershing and the cruise missiles were deployed in Europe. And there was a great deal of speculation about what Brezhnev meant. I wonder whether what he meant was the first steps to develop these two new systems, which we are seeing Now, anyway, Putin then had more to say. We have succeeded in developing other super complex systems similar to the Burevestnik and Poseidon, which demonstrates that research institutions, universities and schools, manufacturers and the economy as a whole have immense potential and opportunities in today's world. Now, he doesn't provide a huge amount of details there, but he does say this, and this, of course, has applications to the development of the civilian economy. As I have already said, Burevestnik and Poseidon rely exclusively on domestically manufactured materials. A major effort to promote cooperation involving thousands of people enabled us to create a real treasure trove of new materials, technologies, unmanned devices, software and digital solutions, and elements of the components base. By putting them to use, we can achieve breakthroughs not only in defense manufacturing, but also civilian sectors while carrying out multiple priority national projects. And then he talks about using small nuclear reactors for powering the Arctic zone and exploring new and deeper space, including powering the spacecraft we are developing right now for delivering heavy payloads. So the Russians, like the Americans and the Chinese, are busy developing a new super heavy rocket, sort of Saturn V type analog. But Putin here is hinting that the Russian version might be nuclear powered. Just saying, using the technology just developed for the Burevestnik and the Poseidon. I'm not going to pretend I understand how that works. I'm sure many people will have their thoughts. Some will say it is technically impossible. I wonder. He then goes on to say this could also be used in the future for the base on the moon. Now, that is being developed in terms as part of a cooperation with China, just saying. And then he goes on to say the small weight size, weight and volume of these new nuclear generators, along with their safety and reliability, allows for flexible use in creating power units for mineral extraction in hard-to-reach areas, including offshore Arctic fields, providing light and heat to remote regions and communities, and increasing the efficiency of underwater expeditions exploring the world ocean. Of course, he doesn't mention submarines, but the use of such systems in submarines, military submarines, I would have thought was also obvious. And then he goes on to say the components and electronics developed for the Burevestnik and Poseidon will also be instrumental in creating powerful computers, as well as in the development of digital infrastructure, control, and communications systems. Now, well, there's an awful lot to be said here, but to my mind, if the Russians, well, given that the Russians have indeed managed to miniaturize a nuclear reactor, then all of these possibilities, as I said, immediately come to mind. I am aware already that the Russians have a major program to upgrade their chip technology and to bring them level in production of the ultra highest chips by the 2030s. Now, given that Rosatom, the nuclear engineering company in Russia, is the company that has played the major role in developing these new miniature reactors, I think the logic of making Rosatom the lead company in development of these chips, which has puzzled me up to now, starts to make sense. Not only will Rosatom have developed systems for the computer control of these reactors. But the marriage of the power that these reactors produce with the computers that Putin is talking about, well, that becomes obvious as well. Anyway, it seems to me that the breakthrough the Russians have achieved here is being underreported in the West. I wonder for how long that can continue. Anyway, this is where I finish today's program. There'll be more from me soon. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Please remember also to look up our Substack site. And last but not least, please remember also to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.